Before we get to the interview, I'd like to take a quick moment to talk with you about a need we have. As we've mentioned in the middle of our podcasts for the last few months, we're working on a project to raise a little over $20,000 this year to help us conduct small church pastor workshops in Indonesia, Malaysia, Austria, Switzerland, and Germany. So far, we've received about $15,000 through your generosity. Now, once we're on the ground in these places, most of the costs for food, transportation, and housing will either be very minimal or will be provided by local churches. So the bulk of the costs are to help us get there. It's for airline fares. So here's our current challenge. In September, we leave for Malaysia and Europe, but we need to buy the airline tickets now. And the funds we currently have are approximately $5,000 short. So if you can help, go to karlvaders.com/support and donate any amount you're able to. And please be sure to give us your contact info so we can thank you for your generosity.
What's it look like to be a Christian in the workplace? The first thing is you just do a good job.
Hi, I'm Karl Vaders, and welcome to the Church Lobby, Conversations on Faith and Ministry. My guest in this episode is Andrew Hamilton, and we'll be talking about the content from his book, The Future is Bivocational, Shaping Christian Leaders for a Post-Christian World. Over the last few months, I've had several podcast conversations about bivo and co-vocationality, about side hustles for pastors, and I've written articles and taught conferences about these subjects as well. And I'm going to tell you, more of them are on the way. Why? Because as Andrew said in the title of his book, the future is bivocational. The good news is that the church's past was also bivocational, so there's a lot of help for how to do this well. So in this book and in our conversation, Andrew walks through the theological foundation for bivocational ministry, including how work isn't a result of the fall, but that work is an element of God's creative design for us. And then he gets into some very practical steps if you're considering becoming bivocational, including how to have upfront conversations with your church leaders about how this is going to change things, deciding which tasks are essential for you as the pastor to do, knowing which tasks others can be trained for and trusted with, the non-optional tasks of leadership and communication, and why he tries to function at 70% of his capacity to give himself and his ministry the necessary margin. That and so much more is in this very helpful conversation. And don't forget to stick around when the interview is done. I'll come back with a quick take on work-life balance as a bivocational pastor. Well, Andrew, welcome to the Church Lobby. It's good to have you here.
Thanks, Carl. Great to be here with you.
Now, that is a lovely accent. So you are located where?
I'm in Perth, Western Australia, the most isolated city in the world.
Yeah, you and our friends, the Finkeldes, are there in Perth as well.
We'll see. John and his wife.
Yeah, I've worked on trying to get to Perth, and a couple times I've had it halfway there and we've had to cancel it, but someday I'm hoping to get to Perth. I've been to the other side of Australia, which is where everybody seems to go for their first trip.
That's right. Now, Perth is beautiful, man.
I've heard that Perth is really, really nice, but like you say, it's very remote, which is why it's not a place a lot of people get to, because it is such a long distance to get there. But I'm hoping one of these days that I can. Well, we're going to talk about your book, The Future is Bivocational, which I had a chance to read, and I've got so many notes, and I'm sure we're not going to make it through all of them because there's just so much rich stuff in there. But what I really want to do is walk through some of the basic content of the book. But before we do, how did you get to the point where you were interested enough in bivocational ministry to write an entire book about it?
I wasn't initially. I've been in ministry 32 years, and most of it bivocational. And originally, I just did what everybody else does. You know, the church can't afford a bivocational pastor, so you go bivocational. And I was a phys ed teacher. I worked in shops. I did a couple of different things. And then we planted a church one year. Along the journey of that, without giving you the whole story, I started a small business. And part of our goal as a church was to be in the community and connect with people. As a pastor, you always want to know the people in your community. What I discovered was I was getting to know people in my community far better and far more of them by running a small business than I was as a pastor. And it was then that the lights went on and I said, oh, Paul knew what he was talking about. And that was probably 18 years ago. And since then, I've been running business and being a pastor ever since.
Yeah, you mentioned even in the intro to the book, or you asked this question, so I'll ask it of you. Why is full-time pastoring perceived as the preferred outcome for a person with a sense of calling to vocational ministry? Why are we coming in the Western church world so late to the idea that bivocational, co-vocational, whatever term we want to use, is not a secondary calling? Why are we so late to that, do you think?
Look, it sounds really terrible, but it's just that's what we're familiar with. That's what we expect in a Christendom world where Christianity has been our dominant form of spirituality and religious expression, and pastors have been able to get full-time gigs. We just think that is the norm. So bivocational, it's just really sad if you have to do that.
Yeah. And we've all seen that, haven't we? Where both from pastor's viewpoint and from a church standpoint, you look at the bivocational pastor, and like you just said, well, it's just kind of sad. Oh, that poor guy can't quite make it in full time, can
That's
he?
it. That's
Yeah.
right.
And we end up in this spot, but I'm beginning to rediscover. So you are one of several conversations I've had recently about bivocational, co-vocational. And for our listeners, for those who haven't heard it before, the way I see the difference between the term bivocational and co-vocational is bivocational is often used for a pastor who has to work outside the ministry but is doing it until they can be full-time in ministry. Co-vocational is a new term that's coming in that typically is used for someone who's doing it intentionally. You use bivocational really for that second meaning, though, don't you, in your book?
I do, just because I think it's more in common parlance than
Yeah.
co-vocational. So I think co-vocational is probably a better word, but people would probably ask the question, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, if you were writing your book 10 years from now, maybe the co-vocational would have taken hold and that might
Absolutely.
have been the title. But yeah, so for now you're talking about not doing it because you have to, but doing it for all kinds of very strategic and theologically profound reasons. So let's start looking at some of that as we go through it. Some of this is just going to be me quoting you back to yourself out of the book and getting some of your comments on it. You say this: one key is pastors are freed from the need to monetize the church in order to generate enough income to sustain their salary. So you said that in your experience, the pressure to generate income releases a pastor to lead with a clearer mind into a complex and uncertain future. In other words, if I can be paying the bills outside of full-time pastoral ministry, then there's less pressure to monetize full-time professional ministry, and there are some downsides to the necessity of having to monetize full-time ministry. What are some of those downsides, and how do we avoid it with bivocationality?
Oh, look, I remember chatting with a church planter not that long ago, and he said, look, I've got to get this church to 120 really quickly because that's how many people we need to have to pay me full time.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Unbiblical pressure, too, by the way.
Absolutely. In fact,
Yeah.
when we went to plant a church, our denominational leader said to me, Andrew, you need to get 100 people. This was his figure. You need to get 100 people for a viable church. And I said, what do you mean, Steve? He said, well, I said, what do you mean by a viable church? He said, a viable church is one that can pay the pastor full time. And I just said, Steve, find me that in the Bible, because that ain't the
Yeah.
deal.
Yeah. And the floor for viability keeps growing. When we were younger, there were a lot of places, especially in rural communities, where a church of 50 could pay the pastor who had a family and things were fine. They had a parsonage or whatever. But that has grown now to 100, easily 150. And I don't even know a lot of churches with an attendance of 150 that can really pay a facility and a pastor's full-time salary and all the things that need to go along with it. So that door to entry keeps rising as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's going to only get bigger. You're right.
Yeah, I'm going to admit that some of the growing acceptability of bivocational and co-vocational ministry is because of that raised bar to entry for full-time ministry. I think we both acknowledge that that's part of what's happening here. But that's not where you're coming from. You're not just like, well, we've got to, so let's figure out how to do it anyway. But there are some real advantages and ways that we can be more biblical in our pastoring through doing it bivocationally, aren't there?
Absolutely. And I think, the missional one is probably the one that I want to put right at the top there because all of us talk about wanting to be missional and we talk about our churches being missional. And, sometimes I think that word gets used so much that it's kind of lost its meaning. But if the pastor is intentionally sent into his community every week to work amongst the people and be a very ordinary bloke and learn how to do that, then it's a fantastic model for the people. And it also means when you're talking to your people, you're relating to them as to on a similar level as based on where they're at. And when you tell stories in your messages and your teaching, you're able to tell stories that people listen to and resonate, and they go, you get it because you're doing it. You understand what we're on about. When you roll up to a leaders meeting on a Monday night and you've just laid 100 metres of turf and you're absolutely exhausted and you'd rather go home and go to bed, you feel what some of your people feel every week. That's how it is.
Yeah, it's harder to lecture people for showing up late and tired and taking 20 minutes to get into the spirit of things when you show up late and tired and are taking more than 20 minutes to get into the spirit of things. You know how they feel.
You really do. And I did not know that until it happened to me. You know, I just remember being a full-time pastor, senior pastor for 3 years, and running leaders' meetings and thinking, why are these people so dopey at 8 o'clock at night? And I'd taken a couple of hours off during the day to kind of...
Yeah, you just got up from a nap.
That's right. And one guy used to go to sleep at 9 o'clock. You could just, he'd clock off and he'd nod off. And I used to want to yell, wake up. And now I just think, hey, you probably need the rest, buddy. It's okay.
Yeah. So that's one of the things that I think really does help us understand. I think small church pastoring in general helps to give us that closer connection to the people that we're pastoring. We spend time with them. We hear from their heart. But if you're doing bivocational ministry and you're actually in the secular workplace, I think you have an understanding of the schedules. I think you also get a clearer understanding of what it's like not to live just exclusively within the Christian bubble, surrounded by almost entirely Christians all day long. How does that change your perspective for better ministry when you're spending some time in the secular workplace?
It just helps you understand the financial pressures people grapple with, the relational pressures. You know, I think Jesus must have had this going on. If he was a carpenter for, say, 15 years, he must have dealt with clients who didn't pay on time, people who complained about his work, having to negotiate with other people who you're doing business with, all that sort of stuff that people deal with that generally as pastors we don't deal with. Sure, we deal with complex relationships at times, but it's just the everyday stuff of life that just goes on. And I just think it really does help you understand what your business people, what your teachers, your lawyers, your doctors, your architects, whatever in your church, that they're dealing with day to day.
Yeah, and this is something that obviously this is what Jesus dealt with, as you mentioned. This is also what Paul dealt with. You talk, and we'll get to it in a bit. You do a whole chapter on tent making, and I love some of the ways you look at it, unpack it in ways that I hadn't thought of before. But the idea that full-time vocational ministry is normal, but bivocational is subnormal, is actually the opposite to what we see in Scripture, because we don't see any full-time vocational ministers in Scripture. But we see everybody from Jesus to Paul to the disciples, as far as we know, doing bivocational work. And you talked about it earlier. It was Christendom, really, that made that shift, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Lately, we've talked about recalibrating the church and re-engaging with some of the first century ways of doing things, you know, the apostolic approach to mission and incarnational mission and all those sort of things that Alan Hirsch and Mike Frost write about in their books. But we have not really grappled with this question of the primary leaders of the church do ministry. And honestly, I think it's because, you know, when your salary depends on it, you don't want to rock that boat. It's just too easy to keep rolling as we are, at least for now. I don't think it'll be easy in 20 years' time.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Let's get to it. Because in chapter 3, you talk about four core theological ideas to frame a bivocational approach to mission and ministry. So let's walk through the four of them. The first one that you mentioned, and again, I'm just going to quote some of your words back to you here. At the very center of Jesus teaching his disciples to pray are the words, "Your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven." What does that have to do with bivocationality?
Well, I think if the gospel of the kingdom is the gospel that we're preaching to people, God's rule come on earth as in heaven, then we are looking to understand what it means to live in this world in such a way as we live under God's rule, as we do things his way. So your kingdom come on earth as in heaven. That's just a core idea of what it means to be God's people in this world. If we can teach that, then people go, okay, So the gospel is not just about getting your sins saved so you go to heaven when you die, which is just a terrible, reduction of the gospel, but it's about all of life that God calls us to.
It is one of the core tenets of the Bible, of course, is the idea of incarnation. And primarily, of course, that God incarnated himself in the form of Jesus, but that as he led by example, that we are to incarnate ourselves to be in the world, but not of the world. And quite often we choose not to be of the world, or we choose not to be in the world, while in some ways retaining the attitudes of the world, and it should be the other way around. And bivocationality can help us to put that into practical terms.
Absolutely. And I just feel like as I engage in the world in this way, I just realized that, I had to answer different questions and face different challenges to what I would have if I had been a full-time pastor. And I really enjoyed that because I feel like my primary calling on this earth is to be a missionary. And missionaries must understand their context. So probably the best way of understanding your context is just to just sink deep into it as everybody else has. In fact, one of the things I realized, we moved into a new development in Perth with four other families. We moved in to be missionaries. We all lived in, adjoining streets. The idea being we would have this amazing community that people would want to be part of. And I intentionally only worked 2 or 3 days a week in any kind of work. And I'd go play golf with my neighbors, I'd go fishing, I'd go surfing. And after a while, I found out that one of my neighbors was really angry at me because he resented my cruisy life because he had to go work in a chicken factory and catch chickens and kill them and whatever they do, But here I was, I'd go fishing with him at 10 in the morning when he got home from work, and he got really angry at that because who was I living in this community didn't have to really work a real job.
There's a that's not incarnational, it's really disconnected, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the first of the four core theological ideas. Your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Second one, I think, is really well defined by you in this simple sentence, which we've already kind of touched on a little bit. Jesus was a tradesman who worked hard in his community.
Yeah, I feel like the whole idea of incarnation. I love what Eugene Peterson says, the word became flesh and moved into the neighborhood. And the question that I've asked and just keep on asking is if the word became flesh and moved into this neighborhood, what would he look like? Would we identify him? If we would, what would we identify him by? I'm reading a book at the moment which is fascinating. It's called The Patient Ferment of the Early Church by Alan Kreider. I don't know whether you've read that.
I read that 2 years ago and it rocked me. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
It is. These guys had no missional training. They had no strategic plan. They were just living a life in such a way that when people looked at them, they said, "Wow!" And that was what drew people to them. So I think that's got to be incarnation 101. Live in such a way that when people see you, they praise your Father in heaven. Yeah.
Yeah, for those who want to follow up on that, just so you know, it's heavy reading. But if you love that as I do, The Patient Ferment of the Early Church by Alan Kreider, it's one of those books I'm going to go back to regularly to remind myself of the foundational stuff that it talks about. Yeah. Still under this idea, though, of Jesus being a tradesman and working in his community, and the idea that we have changed in the world but not of the world, often to of the world but not in it. You talk about over the years, Christians have regularly created Christian versions of clubs, associations, and activities that already exist in our community, and that this dualism of creating a Christian alternative to the whatever club actually works against Jesus' calling and Jesus' example to be present in the world. Talk to us through why that's such a dangerous thing for us to be doing, which we, of course, obviously have done.
Yeah, or look, when you move from Christian basketball competition to Christian youth group to Christian Bible study, the basketball competition is a good one. So we used to set up a basketball, we still do, a Christian basketball competition without the same kind of bubble effect to it these days. But I remember in those days, we all played as Christians, and yet we were as rough and we were as dirty as any other team. And you're right, I think it's, I forget the guy's name, but he says, we're no longer in the world. Not of it, but we're not in the world and still of it because within our own little bubble, we let ourselves off the hook with certain things that, maybe non-Christian people wouldn't let us off the hook with if they knew we were Christians. So there's a challenge there to live with integrity and be highly visible to the people around us.
Yeah, when I moved to the church I've served now for 32 years, we had and still have a preschool. And they were going through some questions and some trying to figure out who they really were and what they wanted to do. And so I was the new pastor, so I walked them through it. And one of the big questions they had and one of their concerns was, do we make this a preschool only for church-attending Christians and their kids as a safe environment for their kids, which has some validity, or is this part of the outreach of our church to reach the community, and we're going to open it up to everybody and provide a Christian environment for those who are just secular people who want to send their kids to a safe school and through that have a chance to impact our community. And what we actually did was I pulled out the founding documents of the preschool to say, what was it created for? What was its intention? And the first line of the founding document wasn't that we're setting it up to fund the church. That was the third line. They did want it to help fund the church's ministries. But the first line was as an outreach to the community.
Yep. Yeah.
So immediately it was, no, we can't just form a little bubble and say only Christian kids and only Christian parents allowed. That's not what it's here for. Again, there are reasons to set up boundaries and there are reasons to set up safe places for our kids. I get all of that. But if the pendulum has swung too far, for most of it, it's swung way over to safety at the cost of mission.
Absolutely.
So that's the first two of these core starting theological premises for it. The third one, then, you say churches that have not been led by bivocational pastors may initially balk at the move in this direction, and they may see it as a step backwards. So how do we, you deal with this a lot, we'll come into it a little bit more later, but how do we start approaching a congregation that starts thinking, well, the only reason we're doing this is that it's in trouble, and if we do this, we're going to be in more trouble, and we'll never recover if our pastor goes bivocational?
I think we can actually present them with some of those advantages of being bivocational. So, for example, one of the ones that I think is great is that I'm able to be me. So when you're a full-time GP, you've got to be prophet, apostle, pastor, teacher, evangelist. You've got to be all those things. I'm pretty good at leading, communicating, and meeting with men. I'm not real good at pastoral care. I'm not real good at admin. Certainly you don't want me running a kids ministry and youth ministry. My days are gone and those sort of things. So, you know, I can do three things well. And in 2 days a week, I've got time to do those three things really well. And I don't have to attend to the things that really don't work for me or I can't do so well. One of the things I was able to say to the church was, you get the best of me, you don't get the worst. Mm. And there are other people who will do these things well. So just, for example, my wife is brilliant at pastoral ministry and brilliant at admin. So we make a good team. I can give all that stuff to her and she smiles and I get all the other stuff and I smile. And when you're bivocational, assume a church has, say, 5 days of ministry budget to spend. You can spend 2 days on someone like me. You can spend 2 days on someone like my wife. You've got a day then that you can spend doing something else. So you actually get specialists in a field rather than just someone who's hacking their way through half of it.
Yeah, a lot of it is it requires you to do some things that we should be doing anyway, really. The delegation, the teamwork, which again, we'll talk about a little bit more because it comes up further in the book. Before we continue, I'd like to take less than a minute to mention three important items. First, if you're new to this podcast, it's a product of Helping Small Churches Thrive at carlvaders.com. We provide encouragement and resources for pastors of the 90% of churches that aren't big through workshops, books, articles, this podcast, and more. Second, our current project is to raise approximately $20,000 to help us conduct small church pastor workshops in Indonesia, Malaysia, Austria, Switzerland, and Germany in 2025, including translating and printing one of my books, The Grasshopper Myth, into the Indonesian language to give for free to 1,000 small church pastors. The churches that need our help can typically afford it the least, so if you'd like to help us do this, you can support us at carlvaders.com/support. And third, you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter and get all the latest resources and news at carlvaders.com/subscribe. Links for all of this will be in the show notes. Now, back to my interview. And then the fourth theological premise that you talk about is this, that by subscribing to the idea that important godly work only happens in the church, we devalue the kingdom impact of 99% of the workforce. Mm. So when the pastor starts acting bivocationally and sees it as a part of their ministry vocation as well, then we start giving other people the opportunity to see, hey, there's ministry value in doing this as unto the Lord. And it's not just simply that now I'm going to, you know, read the Bible, obviously, in front of all my my workers, but you start bringing biblical principles into the workplace because the pastor is living it by example.
Absolutely. I remember speaking to a really sharp, competent woman who worked in a highly, a very responsible job. And I said, "What does it look like for you to live your faith out in the workplace?" And she sort of put her head down and said, "Oh, look, I haven't told anyone about Jesus in a long, long time." And I said, "Hey, look, there is more to it than just speaking the words." And to help her have a frame of reference for what it looks like to work as a Christian, to demonstrate the kingdom of God in her workplace, I think there are a lot of people who still have that idea that I have only done something good for the kingdom of God when I've spoken about Jesus. And if I can take that out of people's minds and just help them understand there are other things to do and show them and speak about what I do, then it actually gives them a real leg up into going, oh, okay. We can simply, one of the things I say to people when I'm talking about what's it look like to be a Christian in the workplace, the first thing is you just do a good job. That's the first thing. You're actually that guy who shows up on time, does your job, and because that's what you're paid for. You're not paid to proselytize, as I often say, but yeah, do a good job.
Yeah, there are surveys that are coming out right now through most of the Western world. Trust in churches and trust in pastors is at an all-time low. The quote-unquote good news in that is that's the same for all institutions. That's not good news, but that's what's happening to all institutions. But if the surveyors ask a second and third question, it changes. If they ask a second question, okay, you don't, so I don't, no, I don't trust pastors or churches. Okay, that's the answer typically, like 70, 80, 90%. But if they ask a second question, do you know any Christians or pastors personally? If their answer is yes, and then they ask the third question, do you trust the pastor or Christians that you know, then the trust factor goes up to like 70, over 70% of them say yes, they trust the ones that they know. Which means if Christianity as a concept, the church as a concept, as a distant thing out there, is less and less trustworthy. But when we incarnate ourselves within the neighborhood, within the workplace, within the school, if they get to know us personally, and I guarantee you, in 70% plus people who say, yeah, I like the Christian I know or I like the pastor I know, my guess is they're not going to say it's because they're always witnessing to me.
Absolutely. One of the stories that I tell in the book is of a lady who lives at the top of our street. And we'd lived in the same street probably for 3 or 4 years. I started doing some irrigation work for her. I redesigned, she was doing a renovation for a friend. I did that job and we did some more work for her. And then after about 5 years, she called me one day and said, "Andrew, I want to talk to you about something. Can you come up to my house?" And I went to her house and we sat down. And as we talked, she told me about a child she'd had 21 years ago who had died very young and partly due to some complications from her own health. And she felt guilty and she'd really struggled with this. And she whispered, I was sitting in a lounge room, she whispered, "She's over there." And she pointed at the corner. And I didn't know what she meant. She'd kept an urn of ashes for 21 years. And she said, "I want to let her go. Can you help me do that?" Knowing, wow. I didn't know what she meant by that, but I said, absolutely. I just know you just say yes. And I was able to lead her through. We went down the beach and we went through a prayer and through a space of time where we let her daughter go. And I thought for 21 years, she'd never asked a pastor to do that. But here she was talking to an irrigation guy who she knew was a pastoral guy. And after 7 years, she felt comfortable enough. And I still look at that and I go, that's a beautiful moment. And she's a wonderful lady, still a good friend.
And not one that you would have gotten if you hadn't been the irrigation guy. Absolutely. Yeah,
No,
beautiful.
no.
One of the things you talk about, and you get to it in chapter four, is you talk about redeeming the our understanding of the theology of work. Because some of us have this idea that secular work is kind of like a necessary evil or something. But in fact, work was instituted to humanity not after the fall, but before it.
Absolutely.
And as you say so beautifully, under a little section called Work as Worship, you say this: originally, our work was intended to be performed in conjunction with the Creator as we tended to and cared for the world He created. So work isn't just pre-fall, which means it's not a result of sin, but that in fact it is a part of our partnership with the Creator God that we serve.
Absolutely. And it was a guy called Derek Girard, who's a Perth businessman. So he's a businessman primarily, and he leads a church as well. So one of the few people I know who says my first calling is to the business world, and I'm also a pastor. But he spoke to me about the word avoda, which is used interchangeably in the Old Testament for both work and worship. And as I looked at some examples of this, it's spelled Avoda in our language. It made sense. So in Exodus 34:21, 6 days you shall work. The word is avoda. In Exodus 8:1, this is what the Lord says: let my people go so that they may worship, avoda me. So those two words are used interchangeably. I think if we can get the idea that our work can become an expression of worship, then it changes the game. It changes how we do things, and it changes the perhaps even the approach we bring to work, which I think can be quite beautiful.
Absolutely profound. And again, we've got to understand this work is not a result of the fall.
Yes.
God worked to create the world. He put us to work and be co-creators with him. And it doesn't have to be just church work. It's any work that we do when it is done as unto the Lord is an offering of worship to him. And we've got to redeem the value of work for its own sake as part of the redemptive way that God works through us, through his creation. I love the way you do that. You then move into, and you talk a bit about the term tent making. When I was younger, bivocational wasn't a word. Tent making was the word that we used. And we, of course, borrowed that from the Apostle Paul, as well as Aquila and Priscilla, who were tent makers, and that was where they received their income. But you talk about how tent making in the Paul model is particularly important for people who are bringing the gospel as the first people to a place, and that isn't necessarily the primary model for how we're doing it today. Or maybe I'm not even phrasing it correctly. Help me with that.
So look, I think for Paul, he had this wonderful business where he could be transient, so he could move from place to place, set a pop-up business, and immediately be part of the local community and engage with the people in those places. Now, I've actually sold my irrigation business. So when I wrote the book, I was just starting another business in caravan way, which I don't know if you have this in the States, but over in Australia, we have lots of people with big cars and big caravans, and they need to know their weights for safety, legality, and insurance.
Here in the US, we call them RVs, recreational vehicles. So,
So people need to know their weights. So one of our intentions when I sold the irrigation business and we finished working in the churches we're part of, I suppose people would call me semi-retired over here, and I don't really believe in retirement as a concept. But the idea was that we would have this business that we could take to a small country town that was struggling to find anyone to kind of go there. We could set up the business because there are always people coming through with caravans and RVs and, whatever, needing wine. And we could help the church out for a period of time, and then we could move on again to a different town, to a different space. And within that, we were straight into the hub of the town, straight into the community and working with the people. And it was going to be a golden way to make things work.
One of the things that strikes me as, and it's something that I keep hearing when I'm talking to people in the bivocational space, is how often there is real opportunity, there's real money to be made, and there's real freedom in your life in doing jobs like tent making, like RV or caravan weighing, that are not fancy, that are not visible, that the mundane tasks that have to be done everywhere. Like Paul making tents, there's no city in his world that didn't need somebody to make and repair tents. Right. But there's nobody striving to become a tent maker as this wonderful goal, like we all strive to be a Hollywood star or a rock star or whatever. No, it's just the basic stuff that needs to be done. But that's where the consistent work will be. And that's where the connecting with people on a real life basis is going to happen most often.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think, for your electricians, your plumbers, you're never going to run out of work. Over in West Australia, irrigation work, it was a very simple job. But when I heard what they were getting paid, I just laughed. I thought, you've got to be kidding me. I think it's about $100 to $120 an hour in our money at the moment, which is a good wage. So you can make a couple $100,000 a year if you ran your business well.
I discovered that when we first came to our church. Again, we've been here over 3 decades now. But for the first decade or more, we couldn't find a good janitorial service because during the week we ran a preschool, and then on the weekend we ran a church, and we didn't have the regular business schedule for cleanup. So it was, you know, that when they needed to be there was different than most businesses. And what we needed of them was different than most janitorial businesses. And every one of them would come in with big promises. And within a few weeks, they'd start slipping on it. Within a few months, we had to get a new service. And I thought, somebody could make some serious money doing janitorial service for churches if they understood this. It's boring, it's dull, but it's necessary, and there's money in it. And as I'm thinking this through, I ran into a bivocational pastor who, in fact, was doing that because he had exactly the same situation. And he thought, somebody can make money here on this who understands the church schedule. And he went, ding.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's me.
One of the businesses we nearly got into was in Western Australia, we have school bus runs. So for people who live semi-rural or rural, a big bus goes around and picks their kids up and takes them to school. Mm-hmm. And they pay very lucratively if you can get into them. You can only take school holidays, obviously. And we explored that. And because we knew of pastors who were bus drivers who knew the people in their town far better than anyone else, because every morning they picked up their kids and they took them to school and they got to know their kids and they got to know the family. And you know, when I hear the stories told of those bus drivers, I go, what a ministry, what an opportunity.
Yeah. And again, it's often the thing you kind of overlook because it's just kind of an everyday thing. But the everyday things is what there's always going to be a need for it. So yeah, let's look into that. Let's move from that, from the tent making, into vocation, because vocation is a big word in the bivocational space that's important for people to understand. So first of all, and let's just ask, and if you could help me answer this question, what do we mean by vocation? What does that word actually mean when we're talking about it in this context?
So vocation comes from the Latin vocare, to be called. So it implies that there is something outside of you that is calling you or drawing you towards a specific task or a focus. So I think for Paul, you know, his calling, I think his calling was not to be a tent maker. His calling was to be the apostle to the Gentiles. Right. But tent making was a great way to fund that ministry, and obviously probably a family business or whatever, he got into it and he knew it well. So easy money while I do what God's called me to do.
Yeah, absolutely. In this chapter, you phrased this really nice, and I underlined it right away because it matches my life. You said this: my own experience suggests that vocation is sensed in younger years, gains clarity in younger adulthood, and sharpens further in middle age. In other words, we have to live through it. You don't decide in advance, here's what my vocation is going to be. You don't decide it, you discover it, right?
Absolutely. I remember going for a job interview when I was probably 32 at a church, and they said, what's your calling? And I just rattled off these words that I still remember now. My calling is to communicate the Christian faith to Australian people in ways that make sense. And I thought, that's what I'm called to do.
Yeah.
Since that day, it's been clarity of message to this particular people. Because I remember growing up thinking I wanted to be an overseas missionary, and I never finished up being a missionary except to Australia. And I just love what God has called me to do. And right now, that's as clear as ever at 60, 61.
Yeah, I'm now in what I would absolutely consider my vocation. And it's an extension of everything the Lord has had me do for the first 65 years of my life. And I look around and go, oh, okay. I was wondering how all this stuff was going to come together. And now I see how the Lord designed all of that. And again, like I said, you don't decide it, you discover it. So this idea, I've never been one for the 10-year plan because none of mine have ever worked out, except in hindsight.
Exactly. But you only know that when you're 60, don't you? You know, you're right. In hindsight, you can.
Yeah. So if you're a younger pastor and you haven't figured it out yet, that's okay. You're not supposed to yet, but you just keep putting one foot in front of the other. Keep hearing wisdom from, you know, folks who have been there before you. Pay attention to what the Lord is showing you as you do it, and the vocation will reveal itself as you move along. That's typically what I've found to be the case as well. So the first half, maybe even two-thirds of the book, you're laying these kind of philosophical and theological foundations and arguments for bivocational ministry, but you get really practical in the last segment of it. So anybody who's looking at bivocational ministry and is even figuring out, like, how do I start doing this and what kind of ways can I approach it? You start to get really, really solid with that starting in chapter 8. And you start, of course, well, I'm not going to say, of course, you start with the importance of prayer. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I just think it's one of those things that when I started writing that chapter, I left it off because it's sort of assumed. But I feel like if we take it as assumed, we sometimes don't do it. So we just need to sit with the Lord and say, hey, let me listen. Let me hear what you're actually calling me to and what you are putting in my heart and the directions that you're pointing me. So if we begin there, prayer, just, it's got to be the starting point. It's got to be the listening. And I say that more listening than saying, you know, praying for people around us, just listening to what God's actually calling us to and hear what he's put in our hearts.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then you start getting into some real practical steps. So let's start looking at some of them. One of the first things you say that a pastor needs to do is there needs to be a serious conversation with your church leadership to determine whether this is an arrangement that they can genuinely support. How do those initial conversations with the church leadership need to go?
I think it's a guy called David Eddington in his book, By Vocation. He says, this is not just a work of the pastor. This is a work of the church. This is something we all sign on to. So if your church doesn't sign on to you being bivocational and to functioning in that way, chances are they may still expect you to behave like a full-time pastor but on a part-time wage. Mm-hmm. So it engages them and it says, guys, what is reasonable? You know, if you were working 2 days a week in your job, what would be reasonable expectations of you and what would you want to do? What do you think would be fair for me? So engaging them in that process so that they understand what they're actually talking about rather than the assumptions that we've inherited over the years.
Yeah, because if you try to do ministry the same way when you are bivocational as you were trying to do it when you were full-time, that's just a recipe for disaster, for burnout, for all kinds of, for stress between you and the congregation members and their expectations. We need to be talking about, and we'll get into it in a little bit, about teamwork, about the kinds of other jobs that other people can take on, about what you're strong at, that you already talked about. You're strong at three things and you're going, I can be good at these three things if I'm doing all this other stuff, or I can be great at these three things if that's all I'm doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And yeah, if they can appreciate that, it's a great place to start from rather than having an awkward conversation 6 months down the track.
Yeah, because it's not, as you said, it's not just the change for the pastor. It's not just the pastor going bivocational. It's the church taking on, in some ways, almost a new identity and certainly a new way of doing ministry with a bivocational pastor. And if they can begin to understand some of the value of it, not just to the pastor, but to them, if they step up to the plate and they start to cooperate with this way in a real biblical way, they can start seeing those things up front. In your experience with those who have gone from full-time to bivocational within a church, let me just ask bluntly, what does the success rate typically look like for that? Are we talking 50-50 or what?
That's a great question, and I don't know. I honestly don't have a figure to give you an answer there, but I do think it's an education process. I don't think any church understands what a bivocational pastor will do until they've actually had one. Now, the church that we were leading for the last 14 years, they were actually really, really good. And perhaps because I'd been in the space myself for a while, I was able to train them and just say, no, I can't do that. No, I won't do that. So if you're a pastor and you're moving into a bivocational space, then perhaps you need to have real clarity around what you will and won't do, what you can and can't do, and perhaps put that on the table very early in the piece so that your people get a sense up front what you're about. And as I say, rather than getting 6 months or a year down the track and them being disappointed with you and you being angry with them, think about it early. Yeah.
And on a practical basis, you step up and you talk about two particular challenges that we need to make. And that I think I absolutely agree. These are crucial in the conversation. You talk about teams and you talk about tasks. So let's walk through those two things. You talk, first of all, one of the first things that we need to do is we need to set up teams. And when you're talking about setting up teams, I love the way you phrase this very short sentence, but I think it says a ton. Think apprenticeships rather than classrooms as you're setting up your teams. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, the whole approach of, I learned this in youth ministry, the four stages of I do it, you watch, I do it, you help, you do it and I help, then you do it and I go do something else. So when we were doing that in the churches I've been part of, I would just walk alongside people, gradually releasing the responsibility until I went, you've got this, I can be better serving over here or training someone else. And I think if we can do that, then we don't just throw people in the deep end and expect them to do something that they don't have competency for, nor do we sit them down and just teach them academically what things look like. We actually help them on the job and we interact with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think another word for apprenticeship is, I don't know, maybe even discipleship, which I think is something we're called to do.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Going back to that book, The Patient Ferment of the Early Church, because I'm literally in it, I thought it was interesting that Cyprian had 120 precepts or tasks that he set his people. The idea being that as they did these things, they formed themselves in the way of Christ. So it was It was acting yourself into a new way of thinking rather than thinking yourself into a new way of acting.
Yeah, that is another thing that book really helped me with as well. The behavior of the early church and even the process through which you had to go through to be baptized, for instance, they took this stuff way more seriously than we do. And it worked. As you, when you see the growth of the early church, I read a book like that and I go, why aren't we? Well, one reason we aren't is because it's really hard. Two, as you already talked about, we're used to this other way.
Yeah.
But I think bivocationality, what it does is it forces us, if we're going to do it right, we've got to assemble the teams that we should be assembling anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And in bigger churches, I guess, you know, maybe you have people clamoring to be part of those teams or wanting to be part of those teams. In our smaller churches, we're just tapping people on the shoulder and saying, hey, I've seen you. The kids love you. Would you consider, I mean, our current children's pastor was someone who came to faith in the church out of a really rough background, lacked a lot of confidence, but now is 4 years into being a children's pastor and is amazing. And when I first mooted her name as someone to do it, we kind of looked at each other and went, really? I went, yeah, she's good. And, you know, we've been able to unearth this incredible talent, which probably wouldn't have happened in a bigger church because she might have put her hand up to volunteer once a month to teach, but she would never have put her hand up to lead.
Yeah, yeah. So that describes the first challenge, which is putting teams together. The second challenge that you say we need to face are the tasks. You put it this way, there are many tasks you can put your hand to in ministry, but knowing where to best invest your time is essential. That's essential anyway, even if you're in full-time vocational paid ministry, but it becomes critical and even more important when you're bivocational. And the key quote for me in this section, which we actually already referenced a little bit, was do what only you can do. Give your best energy in the areas where you are most gifted.
Yeah, absolutely. So I talked about myself. I lead, teach, and meet with men. My wife, she just seems to be able to get her head around. She loves helping. So administrative stuff, which just drives me insane, risk assessments, policies, all that stuff you need to have now to be a church. I guess it's the same in the States as it is over here. Mm-hmm. Whole bureaucracy of church. She manages that, where I just go, oh man, take me back, take me back. And I just think, wow, thank you. Thank you. And she does it well, because if I did it, a whole lot of stuff would get left undone. Pastoral care, sometimes people call me for pastoral care. I'll often, in those situations, I may go with Danelle. She'll be the first one to speak and she will lead the conversation because she just seems to know how to operate in those situations more intuitively than I do. Now, I've got a skill set which I can draw on, but you know what it's like. People know when you're a real pastor, and they know when you're not a real pastor, and she is a real pastor.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about the human condition, but some of us have this sense that if it's not super hard for us, then somehow it doesn't really matter. And the idea of only doing the things we're gifted and good at somehow almost feels like cheating for some people. Or I don't know why, because we need to be more results oriented than work. It's not how many hours I put in. It's not how painful it feels to me to do. It's what was the end result. And if the end result is going to be great and it happens to be easy for me, then that's just benefit all the way around.
Everybody's winning. Absolutely.
Everybody wins.
People are much happier when Danelle's pastoring them. Yeah.
Yeah. So these tasks need to be delegated to teams, but you do say that there are two essential elements that are not optional for any pastor. They are leadership and communication. Walk us through those two essentials and why are they essential?
So leadership, particularly if you are, however you call it, the senior pastor or the team leader, you need to provide a level of leadership to your teams so that, you know, it can be as collaborative as you like, but someone still holds that thing together. So I think of the point guard on the basketball court. Someone's running the play. Someone's calling people into the positions they need to be. So you need to be able to do that. And you need to be able to have a reasonable level of competency at that. And if you're not reasonably competent, you need to get competent because you just need to do it. And if you don't lead, someone will. And it may not be the person who you want to lead. So I just think that's critical. And I say communication because it doesn't have to be preaching. Right. It doesn't have to be stand and deliver. It needs to be, but it needs to be in a way in which if you are the primary communicator, you're the one who's going to be teaching the church the stuff that you want them to know primarily. So you need to be able to do it in a way that they engage with and that they hear. As I say, if you're not a brilliant preacher, You can do it in other ways. You can do interactive type teaching. You can use a whiteboard. You can, you know, sit in rows, sit in circles, however you want to do it. But you need to be able to do that stuff.
Yeah, because if you are going to be called to lead, you have to communicate that leadership vision in some way. And you have to do, there's a certain point where you can communicate it to somebody who then can communicate it maybe to a wider audience, to a broader audience, or whatever. But at some point or another, you are going to have to communicate, and you're the only one who can communicate the vision God has given you to others. So those two things, I agree, are the absolute. And I think I don't know of any others that are absolutely non-optional. I think those are the two non-optionals that we all have to figure out how to do one way or another.
Probably a level of pastoral care might be, yeah.
Now, initial communication, or are you, your initial leadership may be in concert with a leadership team, and the original communication of it may be within the leadership team, then it goes to others. But at some point, you're going to have to be a part of a central role in both of those pieces. I agree that completely. As we get to the end of our time, and when you get to the end of your book, you start to get into some really, really practical things. One of the things you do is you list eight options for finding work, like different types of work to look for if you're going to go bivocational. I'm going to put that in the bonus content. So all of our listeners, if you are really considering bivocationality, but you don't even know where would I begin to look for work, we're going to give you eight serious options for this. We're going to do it in the bonus content, and you can get that in two ways. One, you can become a partner with us in this ministry by going to carlvaders.com/support. All of our monthly supporters get a bunch of bonus material, including all the bonus content for all the podcasts. Or you can also get that for free by going to carlvaders.com/subscribe. You get the free newsletter every Friday, and in that you get advance information of all the things that we do, including all of the bonus content for all of the podcasts and eight options for finding work that we're going to be doing at the end of this. So as we begin to wind this down, and we'll come to the lightning round soon, just to give everybody an idea of what else to expect in the book, The Future is Bivocational, you also cover several practical points on how to get better at maximizing your sermon prep time once you've got less time in the church office, for instance, how to streamline your leadership meetings. That right there may be a reason to go bivocational. If you can streamline your leadership meetings because you've gone bivocational, I can see a bunch of pastors going, count me in. I want fewer leadership meetings. How do you handle emergencies as a bivocational pastor? How do you hand off the administrative work? In what ways do you handle the overlap between your work life, your secular work life, and your ministry life? There are boundaries to be drawn there. There are overlap. How do you manage the expectations of the congregation? You go through all of that in some very, very practical ways. But I'm going to let folks read the book to discover all of those great things, because you got to give them a reason to pick up the book as well. And again, I really highly recommend that you do that. So let's end with this before we get to the lightning round and then go to the bonus content. You say near the end of the book that you, bivocationally, you aim to work at approximately 70% capacity. Why is this? What's magic about 70%?
Okay, it's a little bit of a random number. I don't know whether it's 71 or 72, but about 70% because my intention being that I want to have space in life. I want to have space to actually enjoy life. I want to have space so that when I'm walking up the street and I see my neighbor sitting out the front watering his lawn, I can stop and talk. I want to live an enjoyable life. And I don't want people looking at me as a pastor and seeing me running frantically from meeting to meeting to task, from task to task, and go, wow, that guy's got a really busy life. Look, when people ask me, the question that people often ask one another these days is, hey, you're busy. And generally the answer is, no, not that busy. I got enough on, but I want to live at such a pace that my life looks attractive and that I can enjoy it and I have space. As a missionary, you've got to have space, you've got to have availability. So if you're going to be in your community, you need to have time to be with the people that God wants you to be with.
One of the key things that you mentioned about the 70% is when you do that, you say you're rarely rushing and you're a nicer person to be around.
Absolutely.
I have discovered that for me. I don't mind the work. In fact, I love the work, but the urgency is what gets me stressed out and makes me a harder person to be around. I can keep the same pace if there's less urgency, where I can, if there's an emergency, respond to it, where I can, if there's something enjoyable to do with the grandkids or the family or a place to go that we're invited to. I can do that without going, oh, I wish I could, but I can't because I'm so busy. Yeah, I can, because not because I've reduced my workload so much, but because I've reduced the urgency of it. And I do feel like I'm working at about 70% rather than 100% capacity when there's not, this has got to be done by tomorrow, happening all the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, reducing urgency is something I highly, highly recommend. Again, so many practical things in this book that I really highly recommend people get to, but let's get to the lightning round and then we'll do the bonus content for our partners and our subscribers. All right, question number one in the lightning round is this. What are the biggest changes you've seen in your field of ministry in the last few years and how have you adapted to them?
Yeah, look, I think one of the biggest challenges that I see is challenges is that churches are getting smaller and bigger. So I see the middle-sized churches starting to disappear. We're getting mega franchise churches and we're getting small little family type churches, community churches. So I think one of the challenges to ask, if you're in the middle, which way are we headed? Are we going to embrace more of the filling a niche in our community and being highly relational and connected and simple? Or are we going to join with a franchise and be part of a, I think you call it Home Depot, we call it Bunnings over here. Are we going to be a franchise type church and just offer every good and service possible to mankind? So that's definitely one of the things I'm seeing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think you're right. If you're in the middle, you really need to decide which one you're going to head towards, because I don't think that ministry, that middle size, they will always exist, but I don't think that middle size is going to be long-term sustainable for the next few decades. There are too many factors working against that particular model of church. The big ones will survive and they'll be fine. The micro church has less overhead and can survive as well, but that middle is going to be harder and harder as it goes along. Yeah, great point. Second one, what free or cheap resource like an app or a website has helped you lately that you would recommend for small church ministry?
Gee, that's great. Having been out of it for a couple of years now, I'm really struggling. But look, I guess I'm a podcast fan, so I'm probably going to say podcasts like your own, the Exponential Podcast. I find it hard to find, you know, really, really good podcasts for our type of ministry, but probably following links from yours and Exponential to other podcasts, they're probably where I go these days. Yeah. I don't have an app for my space.
That works. That works. Third, what's the best piece of ministry advice you've ever received?
From my mother-in-law, which sounds strange. We were moving into a new community. So we were going to plant a church, five families. I said, Val, you know, I'm reading all the missional stuff. I'm reading, you know, Alan Hirsch, Mike Frost, Guder, all those guys. You know, I'm reading all this stuff. I said, Val should be a long-term pastor. What would you do if you're moving into a new community as a missionary? She thought about it for a moment. She said, I think, Andrew, I would just live my ordinary life. And I thought that was really lame. I thought, what are you? I come to you for wisdom and you give me that. But you know what? Living your ordinary life when you're surrendered to Jesus, that's all you need to do. And as I embraced that, I've been able to go, well, I just live my ordinary life. If I stay close to Jesus, then all I've got to do is be who I am. I don't need to impersonate myself and be some, you know, caricature of a missionary or a pastor I think I need to be. I can just be me. So that has been incredibly freeing.
I love that. That makes a lot of sense. And thanks to your mother-in-law for that. And then the last one, what's the funniest or weirdest thing you've ever seen in church?
Preaching one morning in a larger church that I was leading one day, I look out and I see this woman walk in late and she's wearing stilettos, a really tight dress, and she is ripped. And I'm thinking, wow, this woman's really built. Anyway, come to the end of the service and this woman claps and cheers and I'm out in the foyer afterwards. I'm thinking that was a weird experience. Someone says to me, hey, have you met this bloke? And I'm looking all around for this bloke. And I realized that that woman was actually a guy. This is going back like 25 years when this whole stuff wasn't alive, you know. So a bloke had come to our church in a dress. He was a transvestite guy. You know, one of the most beautiful stories was that our church welcomed him and accepted him and loved him and really cared for him as much as they went into what he was into. But but I just remember thinking, what is going on around here? You know, you're preaching, you got that other story going on in your head. Yeah. So that was
a bit of a surprise.
And beautiful. Yeah, all at the same time.
Yeah, that's really, wow. Okay. Not where I was expecting that one to go. All right. Thank you so much for your time. You got up super early Perth time to be with me, California time. So I appreciate that. We're going to stick around for a little bit to do the bonus content. Again, if you want the bonus content, you can get it by going to carlvaders.com/support/subscribe to become a regular partner or simply to get the free newsletter. And you can get all the bonus material, including the conversation we're about to have about 8 options for finding work if you're going to be going into bivocational ministry. But if anybody wants to find you online or follow up on any of this, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
I have a blog, www.backyardmissionary.com. I've been writing there for about 24 years. So that's my thought evolution over the last 24 years. That's the best place.
Great. And we've also used some of your articles, and some more are coming out on my website, carlvaders.com, from you, Andrew, as well. The book, one more time, is The Future is Bivocational, Shaping Christian Leaders for a Post-Christian World. Thank you so much for your time today, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Carl. Great to be with you.
If you are considering becoming a bivocational pastor, but you're wondering how to fit a secular job into your already crowded schedule, I get where you're coming from. But here's what I strongly encourage you to do. Start with this principle. As mentioned in the main podcast, reduce urgency as much as possible. The way I've done that over the years is that I look ahead at the work that I know needs to be done, the stuff that isn't going to surprise me, but for the first few years of ministry, too often it did surprise me, like preparing for sermons, planning for meetings, getting some writing done, and so on. And I get as many of those things done in advance as I can, as far in advance as possible. Things like planning out an annual preaching calendar and then having that calendar available with you in a notebook or an app where you can add ideas to those subjects as they come along throughout the year. If you do that, you'll be surprised by how much information you've already accumulated by the time you get around to writing it. If we can reduce urgency, work can become the joyous thing that it was meant to be, and you'll have space in your life to be able to do some things bivocationally or as a side hustle that can help bring you some financial freedom. We've got to stop living in a state of constant urgency. Too many small church pastors especially are doing that, and it's unsustainable for you, your family, and the church you serve. It doesn't need to be that way. Reduce urgency by doing the advanced tasks as far in advance as you can get them done. You'll find you'll give yourself, your family, and your church a lot more freedom. This episode was produced by Veronica Beaver. It was edited by Phil Vaders. Original theme music was written and performed by Jack Wilkins of jackwilkinsmusic.com. The graphic design is by Solomon Joy. And me, I'm Carl Vaders, and I hope to talk with you again in the church lobby.